The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Koans of the Way of Reality. Xinyang's Sweet Melons, the main case. Once when Xinyang was a chief gardener, he was tending the melons. Taiyang said to him, "When will the sweet melons be ripe?" Xinyang said, "Now, they're already very ripe." Taiyang said, "Oh, well, pick the sweet ones and give them away." Xinyang said, "To whom shall I give them?" And Taiyang said, "Give them to someone who hasn't been to the garden." Xinyang said, "Do you think that people who haven't been to the garden will eat them?" Taiyang said, "Do you know these people or not?" Xinyang said, "Although I don't know them, I can't help but provide for them." Taiyang laughed and went off. Commentary. There are many kinds of gardeners in the Dharma world, and it's the work of the teachers of our school to set them out, distinguish between the apparent and the real, determine competent from incompetent. And then there's the matter of the produce itself, which are ripe, which are green, when to pick, when to let mature, and ultimately, who to give them to. Xinyang said, "To whom shall I give them?" And Taiyang said, "Give them to someone who hasn't been to the garden." We should examine carefully the feeding of those who have not been to the garden. Xinyang said, "Do you think that people who haven't been to the garden will eat them?" Tell me, what is the meaning of Xinyang's question? Why would they not eat the melons? What is the nature of these melons? And indeed, what kind of eating are they speaking of? Finally, we should understand Xinyang's, "Although I don't know them, I can't help but provide for them." Hearing this, Taiyang laughed and went off. But was this approval or disapproval of Xinyang? The capping verse. The beauty of this garden is invisible, even to the great sages. The magnitude of this activity is so vast, no teaching can stain it. So obviously I couldn't resist. I was looking through this collection, unpublished, unfinished collection of koans that Dada Roshi was working on, sort of off and on over the years. And his vision of this Way of Reality koans, which is Doshinji, Temple of the Way of Reality, was to select material for koans, some case koans from other collections, but his intention was to present them in such a way that they would speak directly to contemporary practitioners. And so his teishos on these were with that in mind. As I said, it was unfinished. It's a very sort of scattershot collection that I have, that I got from him after he died, and I pulled this from there. So it's his commentary in his verse. I couldn't find out anything about Xinyang and Taiyang, and so I don't know where he got this dialogue. So there are many kinds of gardeners in the Dharma world. So the well-known and well-used metaphor of the garden in terms of Buddhist practice, which is a metaphor that goes really all the way back to the Buddha. So preparing the soil before we plant is important. And in a sense, that takes years, the whole of one's lifetime, leading up to the beginning of one's seeking. You could think of it that way. Turning towards the Dharma, or turning towards something, looking for something to make sense of this world, to make sense of ourselves and our lives, and then discovering the Dharma, raising bodhicitta. And what is it that stirs within our hearts, that sort of what constellation of experiences that brings forth a seeking, an affinity with the Dharma when we encounter it? Why you? Why me? Why in this lifetime, so many other things, directions we could have gone, to think of all the things, the ingredients, the streams that fed into our own particular way here, successes and failures, encounters with people, moments, oftentimes moments, I think of moments in my life that came and went without any sense of particular importance, but then those moments, those encounters stayed with me, continued to appear and sort of have presence, moments of wonder, what is this? Moments of doubt, what is this? In a sense, before we plant the seeds are being collected. Our life, our skills, our abilities, our predilections, our misfortune, our good fortune. Bit of a mystery. We can look back and try and trace a line. It makes sense of it because we like to do that. Our mind likes to do that because we are storytellers and that looks like a very good story. And there's merit in that. There's truth in that, but I don't know that we can really quite pull it all together in that way so cogently or need to. Tending this garden, once we enter into it, we see it always needs attention. Because it's growing, it's moving, it's dynamic. It can always grow more fertile. It can grow less fertile. It can become more abundant. It can become dry and wasted. And we see that the longer we spend in the garden, the easier it is to manage. The more we tend it, the more tended it is. In the beginning, you know, it's a bit of a mess. Weeds and tough soil, and we have to work diligently to prepare it. You know, in our consumeristic society, we think if, you know, we can just walk in and put down a buck or two and get what we want and the transaction is completed. And so we can bring that kind of transactional mentality to this. I give something, I get something. Well, when we're not getting what we thought we were going to get, that's becomes problematic, right? Because we had a deal in our mind going. We begin to see it as something different than that. If we neglect it, it's still a garden. It still has all of that potential, but it just takes more effort. And for a while, there's a gate. We put a gate around the garden, keep the critters out, so we can get in and out, kind of protect it. And then we see, we have to realize, well, the critters are part of the garden. They don't know it's a garden. They live here, right? It's their mountain. They don't recognize fences. And so how do we coexist peacefully with those critters wanting to eat all the goods, burrow holes, chip away the roots? If we spray poison over everything, well, we kill all the critters, but we kill everything. That doesn't seem to work. If we ignore them, well, then they just take over. That didn't seem to work either. So we have to be very skillful about dealing with all of this wildlife going on in this garden. And eventually we see, well, why do we even put up a gate anyway? Doesn't seem to keep anybody out. And then we begin to see, well, why did we draw a fence around this garden anyway? Is this the limit of it? Is this the only place that things are growing? Is all of the nutrients for this garden that are necessary just coming from within the garden? We realize, no, that's not true at all. We begin to get the sense that maybe we don't ever really enter or leave this garden. Maybe it's just everywhere. We call that a Buddha field. And so Taiyang said to the chief gardener, Xinyang, when will these sweet melons be ripe? And of course, this is a question everybody wants to know, right? When is your melon going to be ripe? when we'll be ready to pluck off the vine and eat it, so sweet. And that's why it's such a good metaphor, because tending to the garden is essential. We get that. But that doesn't mean we're in control. That doesn't mean we can dictate or even predict, for that matter. We can be certain that good conditions create a fertile ground, what is necessary for those seeds to sprout, for those melons to grow nice and juicy. But we have to let go a whole lot, right, when we want to manage it. Right? You can't plan your calendar around when that melon's going to be right. You have to wait. But the waiting is not just waiting. You're not just sitting there waiting. You're working. You're tending the garden. And sometimes you have to be very diligent. And sometimes you just take a rest. Ease off. And realize that even when you think you're not in the garden, the melons are still growing. How's that working? How does that work? So these gardeners, Dadarushi says, there are many kinds of gardeners in the Dharma world. Are these teachers, potential teachers? Are these students? What are we talking about? Who's in this place, tending this garden? And we need to know when the time is ripe. Ripe and right. If we go too soon, the melon is hard and dry and bitter. If we wait too late, wait too long, it starts to rot. Begins to wither on the vine. It's been neglected. There are many kinds of gardeners in the Dharma world. It's the work of teachers of our school to set them out, to distinguish apparent from real, competent from incompetent. Those who are beginning. Those who are beginning but have already begun. Those who are in the middle and perhaps may have not yet begun. There are all kinds of people in this field needing all kinds of tending. And the thing about this garden is, even if we put a gate up, it's open to everybody. And I spoke last night, it's the garden of the precepts of Zazen, of eight gates, of paramitas, of abundant teachings, practices. It's a lively place, right? From the outside, it looks very interesting, so it draws you in. You want to check this place out. So many good-looking fruits and vegetables to walk around, observe, admire. So it's open to everyone. Not everybody will come. Some will come and linger a little while and leave. Some will come and linger a little bit longer and leave. Some come and never leave. And the teacher's vow is to offer the Dharma to whoever comes seeking, is to make sure that gate is wide open. Dadarushi, in the very early years when he was establishing all of this, God bless him. You know, it's a, I don't know what the word is, curious, wonderful, strange, fortuitous blend of qualities and ingredients that are necessary for somebody to do what he did. Not just to have the skills and the sort of breadth of abilities, a fundraiser, an advertiser, having started his own business, having led retreats, all of these different qualities, and such a strong devotion and love for the Dharma and confidence in its ability to heal the illness, the courage, the commitment, perseverance. And he used to talk about, as he was getting things established and sort of teaching us, helping us understand what are we doing here anyway. And he talked about how the teacher's vow is to teach whoever comes seeking. In a sense, their vow is to never say no, right? Unless that teaching would actually not help that person. And then their vow is to guide them towards what might help them. And so he talked about setting up, establishing the Guardian Council, because he couldn't say no, but the Guardian Council could. If it seemed that that particular melon needed a little bit more time on the vine to ripen, or if, you know, it was in the wrong garden looking for something that they weren't going to find here. Xinyang said, they're already ripe now. They're ripe right now. And they ripen, obviously, at different times. In a sense, the karma within that seed, within that context I talked about last night, not just social context, but everything context. Wendell Berry said, the context of everything is everything. And even those planted on the same day will ripen differently. And we might think that all we have to do is find our way into that garden and then just sit down and start eating sweet melons. But it doesn't work like that. If you try and pick one up, the gardener comes over and says, wait a minute, put that down, it's not time yet. Here's a spade. Go clear some weeds. Even though that person's hungry, even though that melon is just for them, and is ready, is waiting, virtually ready to leap into the hands of that person. The person's not ready. In a sense, all along the way, we are completely available. We are ready. And we also have to prepare ourselves. Each seed is a seed all the way through. Each melon is a melon all the way through. There's just no question about that. Buddhism does not get into that kind of conversation, other than to affirm it. And yet, each seed responds to its own environment, inner and outer. So when we think of our karma as we come into practice and how that impacts our practice, it has a lot to do not just with the things we've done, the experiences we've had, but perhaps to an even greater degree, a more important degree, what we've done with those things we've done. What we've done with those things that we've experienced. In other words, how have we responded to the world throughout our lives, through every day of our life? Because that's how we're going to respond to the Dharma, initially. And so, the gardener is essential. There needs to be a gardener. The seed, the Buddha nature, the student, complete, sufficient. But it must be cultivated. At each and every step, there is cultivation. And with every metaphor, you know, there's a point at which it falls short. Because cultivation has a sense of transforming something into something different, into something better, into something ripe. And in this garden, the seed is already ripe. It's already ripe. And as it becomes a seedling, a sprout, as it starts to grow its arms and legs, become green, buds appear, bees come by, fruit starts to grow. That's just the same thing all along the way, responding to its causes and conditions and appearing in that way, in that moment. But nothing is transforming, ultimately. Nothing is becoming something and then becoming something else. And in that way, for the gardener, for the everybody in the garden, there has to be ongoing discernment. We have to sprinkle some water, let the sun come in, provide some shade, prune, see how the plant responds. I remember Dr. Roshi years ago telling me about a student who came in and said, I really want you to challenge me. I don't think you're challenging me. Really challenge me. And sometime later, I saw that the student was really upset about something. I went in. I said, what's going on? He said, I challenged them. And he said, they said they wanted to be challenged, but they don't. Right? Not yet. Some seeds begin as timid, fragile seedlings, but then grow into vibrant, healthy plants. Others begin with a big bang, but then they kind of burn out, wither. And some are just steady all the way through. It doesn't really matter how you climb the mountain. It's the climbing that counts. The sweet ones are ripe, and so Taiyang said, give them away. In a very real sense, even before they're ripe, they're given. They don't know how not to. Yukon was like, as is part of training, in a way, a part of monastic training is to, in a perfect monastery, which we're not, is to basically have every position, every training position, every service position, so that through the course of one's training, you basically, the monastic basically has a sense of how the whole thing runs, how it works. And it's a most wonderful gift, really, to the Sangha, because then those people, when people move in and out or drop away or go away on vacation, somebody can just jump into that spot and pick it up, right? It's wonderful to be able to give in that way. So he was the cook, he was the work supervisor, he was the bookkeeper. And I was his supervisor. There were sparks flying. There were tears shed by all. And he did all kinds of things, and then he became the gardener. And at the cremation, I was talking to his family, and I said, you know, some people, I mean, many people find a way to be fruitful and fulfilled and giving in their life, and they utilize the life that they've chosen or the life that they've given as practitioners. That's our vow. And I said, and some people seem to really just find the spot, the path, the life that, if we believed in destiny, that they were destined for. And I think he did in finding his place here as a monastic. And then within this place, I think he found his spot in the garden. It was really the place where he, I think, really came to become that sweet melon and learned so much. And at the beginning, you know, he wasn't a gardener. He didn't know much. He studied, he observed, he asked questions. Anybody who came in who had any experience, he asked questions, but became the place of his practice, his cultivation of himself and others, feeding the Sangha, working and playing. Many doksans were about the garden. And he struggled because he fell in love with the garden and all of his many babies, right? All of those little seedlings. And he loved them so much, he couldn't bear to see them wither. He couldn't bear it. Pruning was like a massacre, right? How could he be asked to do such a thing? And so he was constantly coming in and talking about life and death, right? And trying to find the balance. And he understood this is the cycle of things. This is the nature of things. This is how it must be. And he said, I know, but oh, I just want every one of them to live. He wanted each one to have a full and happy life. And then, of course, the critters eating his babies, that was a problem too. He wanted them to live, but not get so fat. He recognized as a Dharma practitioner, as a monastic, that how he developed attachments to the garden and all things garden, his expectations, his dreams and fantasies, and he applied himself. He saw how those attachments caused him suffering. He saw how those attachments got in the way of his being a gardener, of his being with other people gardening. He saw how sometimes those expectations caused him to respond to people when he sent somebody over to weed and they pulled up a whole row of seedlings, right? And he had to work with that particular concert of emotions that was arising to take care of everyone. And it was really a place where I think one of the sort of lifelong koans of his, which was how to bear suffering, how to bear it, which was ongoing, and which the garden supplied him with ample fuel for. How to tolerate another's pain, another's suffering, another's confusion. It's an ongoing practice, and to trust that they are that seed, they are that melon. Help, but don't get in the way. And that's one of the great challenges of compassion, is to really know that each person has their medicine, is their medicine. And so, Taiyang says, well, pick the sweet ones and give them away. Well, to whom shall I give them? And this is the Bodhisattva vow. For all those ailing in the world, unto their every sickness has been healed, man himself become for them the doctor, the nurse, the medicine itself. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may dispel the ills of thirst and famine. And in the ages marked by scarcity and want, may myself appear as drink and sustenance. May I be that glass of water. May I be that bread. And in for sentient beings, poor and destitute, may I become a treasure, ever plentiful, and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all that they might need. My body thus, and all my goods besides, and all of my merits gain and to be gained, I give them all away, withholding nothing, to bring about the benefit of beings. Shantideva. The gardener, the garden, the seeds, the melons, the people. To really enter into that, those images, to be a boat, a raft, a bridge, right? Obviously, he's talking about how do we make our lives, how do we make ourselves, our interactions, our thoughts and words and all of it, an offering. Nirvana is attained by giving all. Nirvana is the aspiration, my striving. Everything, therefore, must be given away. And it is best to give it all to others. Give them away. To whom shall I give them? Sin Yang says. Taiyang says, give them to someone who hasn't been to the garden. To those who have not been to the garden, will they eat? Everyone's hungry. That's just a fact. Everyone is hungry. When we don't know that, that hunger comes out in all kinds of sideways. That's on vivid display right now. Whether we call it a pandemic of loneliness or depression or divisiveness, symptoms galore, but it's all a basic hunger. And that's why the gardener's vow is to give the melons away. But giving them away, we have to be very clear. You give the melon away. And then what the person does with it, it's their melon now. If they ask for help, how do I open this up? What's the best way to eat this? Is it okay that all this juice is running down my arms, dripping on the floor? I was so upset when I started to have watermelons without seeds. I thought, what the? I mean, when I grew up, watermelons were to be eaten on the front steps so you could spit the seeds out. You didn't eat watermelon inside. But you can't try and make somebody eat it. You do that, you ruin the melon. But it is very clear about that. There's a lot of teachings about being generous, not being stingy. The precept of not being stingy is really not being stingy with the Dharma and with the understanding that do not be stingy when someone is asking. When someone is not asking for the Dharma, give them something else. Give them another gift. For you, that might be Dharma. You see that as Dharma. But it doesn't come in that kind of a box. Who would not eat these sweet melons? Sitting by the riverside, crying out for thirst. Sitting by the riverside, thirsty, building a garden, working diligently year after year, and then realizing, oh, my thirst had already been slaked. All of this was splendid indeed. But now its function is different because we realize I actually didn't need to do all that. And I did need to do all that. And maybe other people will need to do all that. So now we have a garden in which to do all that. Dogen said, when you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. When you leave the way to the way, we don't obstruct it. We don't interfere. We don't improve it. We don't manage it, which means we're not doing those things to ourselves. Then we attain the way. And at the time of attaining the way is always left to the way. It's self-fulfilling, in a sense, self-guiding. Really, that's the point of training, is that we receive so much teachings and instruction and guidance. Sometimes I say so that we can begin more and more to guide ourselves, which is true, but really it's so that the way can guide itself, that the Dharma guides the Dharma when we leave the Dharma to itself. And so our practice really is just a practice of continually resisting the urge to get in the way. Xinyang said, do you think those people haven't been to the garden will know how to eat or want to eat? Taiying said, do you know these people or not? Xinyang said, although I don't know them, I can't help but provide for them. Taiying laughed and went off. One big melon. Xinyang doesn't know them. Taiying doesn't know them. The Buddha doesn't know them. Not even in their dreams. But you could also say that we all know these people who have not been to the garden. And the more we practice, the more we meet them in our mind. When we meet our anger, we meet their anger. When we meet our boredom, we meet their boredom. Our faith, our lack of faith, our doubt, our confidence, our hunger, we meet theirs. They might set their table a little bit differently, spice their meal a little bit different. Some put salt on their melon, some don't. But we begin to realize we know each other. We may not know each other's story at all, and that counts for something. But there's something essential that we do know. Thus, the Buddha was able to say, as Hogan mentioned, at this moment, I and the great earth and all beings attained the way. I came across a teaching by a teacher I like, listened to, Thay Sit Thu, and he was talking about devotion. And he said, our appreciation, our admiration, our faith, our trust in the Buddha, that's what we call devotion. It's natural, it's genuine, it's limitless. Why is it limitless? Because the Buddha's compassion for us is limitless. And therefore, our devotion to the Buddha should be limitless. If the Buddha had taught in a limited way, not been open-handed as he said he was, held things back, then our devotion would be limited, Thay Sit Thu says. But his compassion was not. He said over and over, I have held nothing back. At the very end of his life, in his last breath, he said to his students assembled, do you have any questions? And he asked again, and he said, if you're too shy to ask, let the person next tell them your question. Let them ask for you. He says, therefore, our devotion to the Buddha has no limitation because his compassion for us has no limitation. And that transmission of enlightenment, of devotion, of compassion continues through the true lineages. So based on the Buddha, we can have devotion to everything that is related to Buddha. Kanze on it, one with the Buddha, related to all Buddhas in cause and effect. We can have devotion to everything that is related to Buddha, that is the Dharma, that is the Sangha, that is lineage. Compassion and devotion are mutually dependent. They rely upon and rise together. And so that's why Dogen said, know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. So all this week, to be giving to yourself is a part of Dhanaparamita, selfless giving. To give to your family is also giving, even when you give a particle of dust. Rejoice in that act, because you authentically transmit the merit of all Buddhas. That's what Thay Sit Thu is talking about. And in that, you begin to practice an act of a bodhisattva. You become a gardener. And then he said, the mind of a sentient being, by the way, is difficult to change. Oh my goodness. Yes, it is. And it is nothing but change. And so Dogen says, please keep on changing the minds of sentient beings from the moment you offer one valuable to the moment they attain the way, to the moment that they alleviate their suffering. And this is initiated by giving, a language everybody speaks. And thus, giving is the first of the paramitas. When we really begin to examine giving, we realize it's everywhere. It's in everything. Step outside. Spring is like a mad dog explosion of giving. Sometimes it's too much. It's intoxicating, right? There's so much of it that the wind doesn't know what to do. It whips up and it blows trees down, puts out the electricity, right? So much ki, so much life coming. And that's why practicing gratitude is so important in our practice. That's why in every moment of receiving, there needs to be giving. The server brings the food and bows to you. We bow in return. We go in to see our teacher, we bow, and the teacher offers something. Constantly, we bow to our seat, we bow to the Sangha, giving, giving, gratitude. Mind is beyond measure, Dogen says, things given are beyond measure, and yet in giving, mind transforms the gift, and the gift transforms the mind. It's like alchemy. The beauty of this garden is invisible, even to the great sages. Yet its magnitude is so vast No teaching can stain it. And that's why we practice, is to, in a sense, go beyond the teaching and to experience that magnitude, that beauty, ourselves, beyond words.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.